Previously on the Devil's Teeth podcast.
Check all of the party girl. There were certain places that were known as Lover's Lane. You could always find Jeanette in the back of a car. She liked the party. She could have overdosed and died there.
The Brown family has always kind of looked at it as a tough black sheep of the neighborhood kind of family. The girls were always kind of considered a little bit more on the sleazy side. Jeanette, I guess, had got religious towards the end.
The family was attending our church, and Jeanette also attended the church. Although she did not become part of the church, she was reading a book of Satanism, and I think was involved with a group of people that were meeting up in the mountain there.
Oh, God, you see what they did to sick religious minds that made her into something she never was.
A body in the woods. Investigators have a million theories on how it got there, but no solid leads. No cause of death, no murder weapon, no obvious signs of trauma. One detail everyone seems to agree on, however, is this. No matter how she died, Jeanette DePalma was not alone on top of the Devil's Teeth Cliff, deep inside the woods surrounding the Houdai Quarry, on August 7th, 1972. Retired Springfield Patrol Officer Don Schwert explains.
It just bothered me that whoever was with her never came forward. We don't know if she was killed or was a drug overdose or just a heart attack. We'll never know to this day, but I know somebody had to be there with her.
It is certainly easy to understand Schwert's frustration, but maybe there is a way to find answers about that fateful day. Let's start at the beginning. On the morning of August 7th, 1972, Jeanette DePalma woke up in her suburban Springfield home and went downstairs to have breakfast. From there, things almost immediately became tense. Jeanette's cousin, Lisa, had run away a few weeks earlier after an argument with her own mother, a fact Jeanette's parents, Florence and Sal, had kept from her until this moment. For whatever reason, Florence and Sal picked this day to question their daughter regarding Lisa's disappearance. They had not anticipated Jeanette's reaction. According to Lisa, who safely returned home a short time later, Jeanette became very upset with Florence and Sal for keeping her cousin's disappearance a secret from her for so long. After a brief confrontation, Jeanette left the breakfast table and stormed off back to her bedroom. Later that morning, Jeanette called her best friend, Gail Donahue. According to Gail, she and Jeanette had met a pair of boys in Mountainside's Echo Lake Park the day before, and the two had made plans to meet up again at Gail's house the following day. When Jeanette called Gail around 11 a.m. that morning, she was allegedly trying to break these plans. According to Gail, Jeanette told her that her mother was making her scrub the toilets in their home, and she didn't think she would be able to make it. Incensed by this sudden change of plans, Gail told Jeanette that she had better, quote, get her ass over here, as she was now facing the prospect of having to entertain two boys alone. Jeanette thought for a moment before she finally acquiesced, telling Gail that she would hitchhike over to her house in Berkeley Heights in a couple hours. According to Gail, this was the last time she ever heard from her best friend. What happened next became a significant source of controversy while Mark Moran and I were researching and writing Death on the Devil's Teeth. According to Jeanette's sister, Cindy DePalma, after Jeanette hung up the phone, she walked into her room and asked her if she would accompany her to Gail's house to see a boyfriend named Tommy. When I asked Gail Donahue if Tommy was one of the two boys from Echo Lake, she had this to say.
The one Tommy Jeanette did know was actually my boyfriend, and he was from Mountainside.
But that wouldn't have been the Tommy that she was talking about, right?
No, I really, I honestly don't remember any Tommy. She, injured in love at that time at 16, and she hung out with what we called at that time the Greaser Group, you know, the Italians.
When I asked Cindy DePalma if she remembered anything about Tommy, she maintained that she could not recall a last name, general description, or any other details about Jeanette's alleged boyfriend, insisting that she had never met him in person. The only additional information Cindy DePalma offered about Tommy was that her sister's supposed boyfriend, quote, may have lived in Berkeley Heights near Gail. Cindy then went on to tell me that she declined Jeanette's invitation to Gail's due to a fight she was having with her boyfriend that day and wanted to stay home in case he called. Despite Gail Donahue insisting that Jeanette had never mentioned bringing anyone else along to her home, Jeanette seemed bent on finding someone to join her that day. After her alleged conversation with Cindy, Jeanette then called another friend and asked if she would come along. When I spoke with the sister of this friend, who asked only to be referred to as Roseanne, she said, quote, "My sister was asked by Jeanette to go to Summit the day she disappeared. My mother told my sister that she could not go, and she listened, thank God. My sister was very upset and scared when the news broke about Jeanette, which was later that evening when her mother Florence called my mother asking if my sister was home or knew where Jeanette would be. After Roseanne's sister declined her invitation, Jeanette grabbed her purse, a gift from her older sister Carol, and told her mother that she was going to walk to Summit train station 3 miles away. From there, Jeanette said, she would take a train into Berkeley Heights to see Gail Donahue. According to Gail, this was a lie. Jeanette was planning to hitchhike straight to her house. Jeanette's nephew, John Bancy, told Weird New Jersey Magazine the following. Quote, "My two aunts were together, my Aunt Cindy and my Aunt Jeanette. Cindy said Jeanette was getting ready for work, but she was going to stop by her friend's house at the time. She worked somewhere in Summit. My grandmother offered her a ride to work, and she said, 'No, Mom, I'm okay. I'm 16. She was going up to her friend's house, and she was going to get a ride to work. My grandmother said, "You're too young." And she said, "No, I'm 16 now. Leave me alone, Mom." And that's the last time they saw her. After leaving her home, Jeanette decided to stop at her friend Donna Blattis' residence 1.5 miles away. John Rosensky, Donna's widower, wrote to me in 2014 and had this to say. Quote, "Jeanette stopped by the Blattis home uninvited midday. Donna was grounded by her parents and was not supposed to have friends over." Rosensky went on to write that, quote, "Jeanette was not all she seemed to be. Donna's mother, for some reason, did not want her around Donna." Cindy DePalma disputed this claim to me, insisting that Donna's parents liked Jeanette, but Gail Donahue agrees with Rosensky, saying the Blattises did not like Jeanette and had once thrown her and Gail out of a party at their home for bringing boys along. Rosensky continued his letter by writing that his late wife told him that, quote, "Jeanette was having a fight with her boyfriend and was looking for a ride somewhere. Jeanette asked Donna's mother to drive her somewhere. Donna's mother refused and Jeanette left, walking down High Point Drive towards Springfield. This is all I know." Cindy DePalma again found fault in John Rosensky's account of Donna Blattis' recollections, maintaining that her sister and Tommy were not fighting that day, reiterating that she was the one fighting with her boyfriend. Years later, Jeanette's unannounced visit to the Blattis house would become a proverbial gold mine of gossip. According to retired Springfield police officer Ed Kish, a rumor eventually began to circulate within the Springfield Police Department about a party thrown by Donna Blattis and her brothers, Mark and Richard, on the night of Jeanette DePalma's disappearance. According to this rumor, Jeanette DePalma supposedly overdosed on an unknown or unnamed drug at the party and died. Her friends then supposedly panicked and decided to dump her body on top of the Devil's Teeth Cliff. In addition to Jeanette DePalma's friends insisting that she had no knowledge or experience with hardcore drug use, not a single person has come forward in the last 45 years claiming to have attended a party at the Blattis residence on the night Jeanette vanished. Despite all the he said, she said, and finger pointing, one thing remains true. At some point on the afternoon of Monday, August 7th, 1972, Jeanette DePalma's short life came to an end, and her body was left on top of the Devil's Teeth, where it lay decomposing for the next 6 weeks. Gail Donahue recalls the moment she was told of her best friend's death.
"My father called me downstairs, and he said he needed to sit on the couch, and I sat on the couch, and he said, 'They found Jeanette's body.' At that point, I had no reaction. I just went to shock mode."
So it definitely wasn't something you saw coming at all? You were still holding out hope that she was going to be found alive?
"I wasn't hoping. It's because they said we could think she'd run away. And I was just thinking the whole time, damn, she had to contact me somehow, please. Just like it hit the show on my back, you know? Initially, for the first 2 weeks, I said you guys are wrong. And she'd be away. She might have been away, but I didn't know that. I was a cat. I think my father can be up here next day because I didn't put that top socket in the front row and I was going to shuffle.
My parents took me over to the house.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the back room where we used to watch TV. And then I went in and there was that poor Mr. and Mrs. Obama sitting on the couch. And they told me they should have found the sound to the door. So what happened? What happened? And peace. But we said, "Oh, God, help me." That's where she would be found.
Well, Karen was awfully sad about their child. They accepted, so I didn't get it. My friends,
The allegedly odd behavior of the De Palma family in the wake of Jeanette's death did not end there. Gail Donahue also told me about a strange visit that Florence De Palma paid her family a few days after her daughter's body was found. During this visit, Florence De Palma brought along a diary that was ostensibly written by her daughter. After reading several passages aloud to Gail's parents, Florence left, leaving Gail's father to confront her about the strange book. What did he mean by join her daughter?
He thought she might do something to me.
Meaning, end up dead?
Yeah. He thought she was wiped out and out of the mind. And whatever this diary said, I don't know how she spoke to them. And, you know, she came off like a crazy lady, and she must have, which is my assumption. But that was his clear message.
Did he ever bring up what was supposedly written in this diary, what these subjects were? Did he ever discuss that with you?
No, and it was weird because it didn't even occur to me to ask him. I think I was in so much shock. There was one. I mean, how could she be my best friend? I mean, I know that she had a diary.
Despite Florence De Palma's best, if not unconventional, efforts, her daughter's diary failed to reveal any suspects or answers to Jeanette's disappearance and death. For months, her case remained at a standstill, until a young man walked into the Springfield Police Department and asked to speak with Ed Kish. 41 years later, in 2013, that man tracked down my co-author, Weird New Jersey's Mark Moran, and offered to tell his story. Here is a recording of that meeting.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you your name,
because
you want to be anonymous.
Yes. You can call me Terry Rickle.
But for the record, that's not your real name.
No, I have many names.
Okay, Terry Rickle it is.
Okay, all right.
So, Terry, you said to me that you have knowledge of who killed Jeanette De Palma. First, I'm going to ask you, how confident in this knowledge are you that it's the truth?
I'm pretty sure.
Second question is, how did you come about this knowledge?
Her body was found just outside this guy's campsite. This guy lived in the woods where her body was found. When her body was found, he wasn't there anymore. He carried the golf course. There's still golfing, so he would have still been there. Caddy, he's been there for a couple of years. He moves there, lives in the woods, caddies. Seasons change, he goes somewhere else and caddies.
They employed people who lived in the woods?
Well, it was back in the 70s, I mean, you know.
What kind of encampment was it? He had
small
a tent?
Campsite, a tent, you know, 8 out of cans.
On the edge of the quarry?
Yeah, between Mountain View Road and the Wood Hill Quarry, yeah.
Who
just
was
off,
this?
Just off Shumpike Road. He was called Red. He had, like, reddish hair, full beard. Weird little guy.
How long had you known that he was living there?
Everybody knew. Everybody in town. Pretty much everybody. Well, young kids knew.
But did anybody have any idea who he was or where he came from?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So we only know him as Red?
Yeah.
That's it? That's
what he was called, Red.
What did people know about him?
Not much. He just caddied. He lived in the woods, you know, and when the seasons changed, he'd go somewhere else and caddy, where it gets much warmer.
How many years was he at the golf course, do you know?
Maybe 3 years.
How old were you at the time?
21.
So you were considered, you know, a few years older than Jeanette. She was 16.
Yeah. 17. Actually, I was dating a girl whose girlfriend was accused of hiding Jeanette Palma. They thought she ran away.
Now, had there been any incidents that you know of with Red? Had he had any run-ins with the law?
Not that I know of, no.
Is it just the proximity of where she was found that makes you think this?
Yes. And in fact, he wasn't there when the body was found. It was still like good golfing season. You know, he still should have been there.
Ah, so he left before the season was over.
Right. Probably about the same time she disappeared.
To your knowledge, nobody knows who Red was. I mean, somebody must know who he was. I mean, the Baltus were all would have to have a record if they were paying him.
They didn't, well,
unless they were paying caddies.
They weren't the tips. He got favored by the golfers that tipped him, paid him.
You've seen him? You had seen him?
I saw you. Yeah.
Describe him to us.
Tall, thin, wild-looking guy, you know, crazy wild hair. Well, it was a hippie season back then. It was like hippie stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like an old hippie.
I'm surprised that they would hire somebody like that at Bald Straw. It's pretty hoity-toity.
Well, now they're more exclusive. Now they're more, you know, you can't just walk up there and say, I want a caddy, or, back then, you know, up there standing on the weight dealing big gap, you know.
Oh, yeah. But you never heard any stories about this guy behaving oddly around town? Did anybody ever see him?
He kept to himself. He went to the supermarket, he had a shopping cart, and he kept in the woods with him, you know, and he read books.
Wow, that's quite a enticing lead, but almost impossible to follow up on. Where would you look for a red?
He's probably
how old too. Would you say he was?
Maybe in his 30s, maybe late 30s.
How did you know that he was gone by the time this whole thing blew up? Because she was missing for a couple months before anybody really investigated that area.
Well, I discussed it with the police. Actually, I talked to the police about this. They asked me what I thought happened.
Now, why did they ask you?
Because I know things.
What kind of things?
Things, you know.
What kind of things do you know?
I'm just in touch. I'm in touch with the town, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, you were only 21 at the time.
Yeah.
So, did you have interaction with the police for any reason when you were 21?
I was good friends with the police.
Okay, so it was a friendly word. They weren't like, you weren't on the bad,
detective.
You weren't on the wrong side of the law.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. I knew the detective involved in the investigation, we talked a lot, you know. He asked my opinion. I just told him what I thought happened, and,
And did the police have a red on their radar? I mean, was he a guy that they were watching? Did they know he was living in the woods? Because the police would have busted him if they knew he was out there. I mean, that's not something squatters. It's not something that a town like Springfield really would put up with, I don't think, if they knew about it.
I'm not sure if they knew he was living there or not. I'm sure the caddy at the golf course knew he was living in the woods. Didn't really care, you know. And the owners of the property, the quarry property, they done. I don't think they knew he lived there.
Did you have friends? Did you, other people that you hung out with, they knew about this? Did everybody know about Red living in the woods, or is it something you knew?
Actually, I knew a couple guys that used to go up to his campsite and hide out. And he'd come back from Cadian, and he'd bury his money, and he'd watch where he buried his money. And when he left, he'd go down and dig it up and take his money.
Now, do you know the area where she was found? Was that a place where teenagers went to kind of
go
in the woods and party? Or
No way.
So that was not a place where teens went to get
high? No, you couldn't hide your car. If you walk, where are you going to walk from? It's so far away.
Yeah. It's far from everything.
You'd have to park your
car on
Mountain View Road.
Place.
Yeah, you have to park your car on Mountain View Road and walk in, and the police would see your car there and wonder what's going on stuff,
For speculation purposes, what the hell would she have been doing there in the first place? For Red to have killed her there.
Okay, this is my theory. Back in the 70s, all the kids hung out at the high school parking lot. They wanted to get high and smoke some weed. They'd all pile in a car and drive up Mountain View Road, walk this rooftop, turn around and come back to the high school, just hang out with their 8-track players and stuff in the parking lot. And everybody knew that, All the kids knew that. So, I figured one day she decided to walk to town, go hang out at the high school, and she knew there was a lot of traffic on that Mountain View Road, the people that she would know and stuff, So she walked Mountain View Road. Going to Springfield, but unfortunately nobody came by that day that she knew.
Yeah.
She got the end of the road, had to go to the bathroom, walked into the woods, dropped her drawers, not knowing she walked into Red's campsite. It's right off the road. Crouched down, taking a leak, and looks and sees this crazy looking guy and starts screaming. He probably went over to her, tried to start running in trouble, tried to start covering her mouth, and probably killed him.
Had you ever seen Red's campsite yourself?
Yeah.
Do you know exactly where it was?
I used to give tours up there, but it's been a while.
Tours?
Yeah.
What? To your friends, you would tell them where...
Yeah, I heard people there and show them the site,
Where
they found the body and stuff.
You know where they found the body.
Yeah, yeah.
That is mind-blowing that there was somebody right there.
Yeah. The thing was, when the body was found, it was just outside his campsite, up on like a cliff overlooking the quarry, It was his campsite's here, and it was up there. She was placed there, laid down, fully clothed. Her body looked like it melted into her clothing. A skull with long hair on it, but there were branches around the body, like a coffin, put there. So I don't think he really intended to kill her. He just accidentally killed her, by trying to start screaming,
I had always, it's funny you say that, I had always felt that, originally the papers were saying, it was some sort of cult
witchcraft
thing. To me, it seemed like more the person who put those logs around the body, it always seemed to me more a thing out of remorse and guilt.
Yeah.
Than some sort of ritualistic
thing. There was no
thing.
Ritual there, because rituals occur at night, and Red was always there at night sleeping. There's no cults, with the Sabbaths going on. That was up by the water tower. But
Suicide tower.
There was no witchcraft involved in the Jeff Obama murder.
I had always thought that whoever she was with, whether she died accidentally of an overdose or whether she had died of somebody being too rough with her, it always seemed like the little tribute, whatever it was, seemed more like out of remorse and guilt.
The best the guy could do for, you know.
I think you're onto something.
Yeah, well, where's Red?
Now, you told them all of this, right? You told this
to
the police. Well, which police do you
know? Detective Edward Kish. He was the investigator.
Edward Kish.
Yeah.
How did your testimony to the police come about? Did they contact you or you contacted them?
Well, she was young. We all knew each other. I didn't know her, but I knew friends of hers, And they were just asking people, what they thought happened and stuff, What was going on?
So you had never met her personally?
No, I never met her at all. And I might have seen her, but
now, okay. So the police, did you go to the police and say, I think I know something, or did they somehow, were they just interviewing all the people of that age group in the area?
I don't remember. I might have talked to Eddie Kish myself.
But you were acquainted with the police,
and
at some point you said you might know something, and they interviewed
you. I just told them my theory, that's all.
Now, was this a formal thing? Did they bring you into the police station to take your testimony, or was it just...
I put the police station, I talked to Detective Kish in his office, yeah.
Now, we've had an extraordinary amount of people come forward with tips in one way or another about this case. None of them have been your tip. You're the first person in all these years to give us that tip. But across the board, everybody has want to remain anonymous. Why? What repercussions are people fearful of?
Could be lawsuits from somebody, from the family for all the information, the golf course, police department, I don't know.
What's your reason?
I'm a backstage guy, Backstage. I don't want to be on a stage.
So you're not looking to come out and be the angel that solves this whole thing. You're not looking for
still
attention.
Dead, you know.
You're not looking for any personal gain.
Can I get a weird New Jersey t-shirt?
While Ed Kish doesn't explicitly recall Terry being the source of the information regarding Red, he definitely remembers the strange drifter.
Okay, so tell us about our friend who was living there in the quarry. What do you know about him?
From the investigation, information is in the Springfield Police Department that a caddy that worked at the Baltimore Golf Club was living in the woods off of Mountain View Road. And at that time, the Springfield Police Department had gotten information that the only information about him was he was known as Baltimore Red. The caddy did the golf course after he finished whatever his day was, woke up sunlight, walked up Mountain View Road, and then drove through the fence. Well, I believe there was a hole in the fence. And he lived in the woods, like a homeless person, like
those reputable. Right. No, the police never had any run-ins with him prior to that?
No, none whatsoever.
How far was his campsite from where the body was found?
For the information, the Springfield Police Department received. And I honestly can't tell you how long after the body was found that this information came to the Springfield Police Department. But because the information was that he lived in the woods, the Springfield Police Department conducted a search in the area in close proximity to where you might consider the body to be found. So you have to be talking, it could have been anywhere 50 to 75 yards away, down about at least 50 yards. So there was a creek that ran through there, and along this creek, three companies were found where this individual was living. I can only say that because I happened to be over there, was looking for him, and we found the campsite where this person lived. There's no house, there's no hut, there's no lean-tos, there's no sheds or anything. If you want to know what he lived in, if you would ask me, the man lived in the sardine can.
Just
it was a tin box that was probably 8 foot long, maybe 3 foot high, and maybe 3 foot wide. And it kept him out of the weather. There was a blanket in there, there were pots for cooking, there was rice inside this. In other words, he had some type of staple camp food. And that's where this man was living. He got up in the morning, I guess.
But he wasn't there when you were looking for him.
No, he was not.
Isn't that a little odd?
Odd.
You said you found his car.
If Is it on? I will tell you that not too many people thought it was on at the time. Because you're still looking back. If there is no cause of death, why would it be on? Other than this was a person of interest who might have some information. So why the information is because of what he is gonna offer if he's found.
Well, okay, the reason I'm asking is it odd? Because it's still the height of the golfing season. He's gone. He leaves his implements to cook and his food behind, as if perhaps he left in a hurry.
No, because the caddy. The caddy's been working up there. Half of them, they didn't want their names, you know, because there was a percentage that had arrest records. And they might only tell you their first name. They didn't work for the golf club. They were independent contractors.
So there was never, you don't know his real first name, right?
Do I? No, somebody else does.
Who?
Van Calabrese does.
Why do you believe Sam Calabrese is being so elusive when it comes to talking about this case?
Just a quick recap. Sam Calabrese was the detective sergeant in charge of the De Palma investigation for the Springfield Police Department in 1972. In 2013, Mark Moran and I reached out to Sam, asking him if he was willing to be interviewed by us for our book. Sam replied via email, saying he would only speak to us as long as we assured him that our conversation would not be recorded and that he knew the questions we were asking beforehand. Despite the promises that our meeting would not be recorded and providing him with a list of the questions we plan to ask, Sam Calabrese refused to respond to any further messages.
He does not know what you're doing.
Well, he knows. We've explained to him what we're doing. But it just seems odd that somebody, I know he's retired now, but he was basically a public servant, and all of this stuff should be a matter of record.
He wouldn't feel that way.
But it's a fact, whether he feels that way or not.
Listen, if you're a newspaper reporter and you gave it to the Springfield Police Department, you wanted some information, we as the detectives at that time had the right, per the chief of police, to release information as long as he knew what we were releasing to the newspaper. So that he wasn't blindsided to the point that we released something that maybe we shouldn't have released. So that if reporters came in on any type of a case, they could, if we wanted to, give him information. There would be some reporters that would come in and be very pushy. You guess where they wound up? They wound up out the door. There would be other reporters that could come in and could write good articles. And that would be spread a lot of information. I can tell you personally that if a reporter came in and wanted some information, I would say to them, would you hold off on writing this story for a couple of days? Could you give me 2 or 3 days? And they said, no, I don't want to wait that long. I said, good, get the fuck out the door. I'm not talking to you.
Ed, we're giving you 40 years.
They would say, you can't do that to me. I said, yes, I can. You're coming to me. I'm going to give you information, but I can't give it to you right now. I said, you want the story? Come back, please. Nope, I want it now. I said, get the fuck out. And then, of course, 2 days later, they called up and committed to apologize and everything else. It's fine. We would sit down. In other words, the reporters couldn't push for it because this was stuff that was part of a criminal investigation that's not public information at the time. They have to remember there's only certain things that are released to the public.
Right.
Off-scale accidents, pedestrian accidents, fires, burglaries, but not so much the essence of who might be a suspect. Was this particular house broken into or where the houses were broken into? Very, very few stories were released.
And they subsequently tracked him down and brought him in for questioning?
I believe that the Springfield Police Department put a significant number of effort into trying to locate this individual. I, for some reason, want to believe that there was even a flyer put together. And out of all this effort, the man was identified. And I can only tell you, if it's correct, his name would have been Rick Gere.
And
it could be his legitimate first name.
Do you know if they brought him in to the police department for questioning?
I know he was questioned. He was spoken to. I believe his family lived in Georgia. Now, this is just a conjecture on my part because I believe he came from a family with money.
Is that where the police found him, back in Georgia?
I believe that they contacted his family in Georgia, and it was through that they were able to get together. I believe that there could have been an attorney present on his behalf. I can only tell you is that whatever the outcome of that interview was, I want to say he's cleared, but he's no longer a viable suspect. I believe Sam Calabrese was present when he was spoke to. The only reason I say that, Sam Calabrese was a very aggressive, positive person, and he would have gone out of his way to make sure he would have been there when he was spoke to. So, with some place, he could have been interviewed at the Unicast Prosecutor's Office.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question as a person, a detective, somebody of a curious nature. Red is living in the woods approximately 50 yards away from where this body lay in the middle of the hot summer for 6 weeks. Don't you think he would have smelled the body?
No. No.
Why not?
Because it was up, he was down.
Well,
You're not going to smell a body until you get fairly close to it. 50 yards, 75 yards, if not any further than that, you're not going to smell it. It's like coming across the pit here. You're not going to smell it unless you're within 50 to 75 feet of it. That's why I always keep a bag of lime here in my garage. All the deer that are down here by us, if a deer runs across the road, get smacked by a car, a couple of them have crawled up into the woods on my property. And I've got to be within 50 feet. I can't smell them at the house. And that's 200 feet away from the road. And when you get within 50 feet, you know it. I'll just take a bag of lime out there and dump it on it. Today, it's gone. So where he would have been, no.
So where does this leave us now? Terry Rickle brings Mark and I the very first viable suspect in this case, Red Kira. But Ed Kish maintains that the Springfield Police Department and the Union County Prosecutor's Office looked into Red, interviewed him, and cleared him. But still, questions remain. Despite Kish maintaining that Red Kira was not a good suspect, there is still the issue of him vanishing right around the time that Jeanette DePalma disappeared from his camp, which was only 50 to 75 yards away from where the body was found. And he didn't just pack up to go to another golf course. As even Ed Kish admits, he left all of his material belongings behind. His books, his blankets, even his cooking equipment. One of the pots still had rice in it. But still, Terry Rickle's theory doesn't make much sense either. We know from Cindy DePalma and Gail Donahue that Jeanette wasn't just wandering around trying to find someone to hang out with that day. She had a destination. She'd left her home that afternoon, fully intending to see Gail in Berkeley Heights. She had approached at least two people looking for a ride there. She told her sister that's where she was going. She told her mother that was where she was going. So the idea that Jeanette DePalma somehow ended up on the other side of town because she decided to go look for people partying in the parking lot of the high school doesn't make much sense either. But still, with that in mind, how did she get in those woods? If she didn't die at a party and was dumped there by panicking teenagers, and she wasn't killed accidentally by a strange hobo trying to silence her in his camp while she was looking for people to smoke pot with, then why was she in those woods? That's not the route you take to get to the train station or to Berkeley Heights. Well, as we will discuss in the next episode, Mark Moran and I may have found the answer while investigating the murder of a young woman who disappeared only 8 days after Jeanette and less than 10 miles away. On the next installment of Devil's Teeth, we're going to look at the mysterious death of Joan Kramer. Special thanks to Mark Moran, Mark Skirman, Don Schwert, Ed Kish, Terry Rickle, Gail Donahue, Rusty and Christina from Antiquity Echoes, and Weird New Jersey's Cult of the Letter Senders.